Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 at this point. Residency has been a wonderful time. It's been quite busy. That's why I'm recording a podcast at 4 a.m. in the morning. But in today's episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast, I believe this is our 39th episode, we'll be continuing our discourse on neuropharmacology. Today, I'll primarily be talking about seizures. This is an area that's typically very frustrating for people, but there are a lot of high-yield things you need to know, and I'll try to put it in a format that is a lot more digestible than the information you'll find in First State, for example. So let's begin. So for seizures, right, so we'll start with a simple, relatively simple kind of seizure. There's the febrile seizures, right, and the classic way it presents is in a child with high fevers, and they tell you that the child has like one generalized seizure. Okay, generally for that, you go ahead and use NSAIDs. Usually don't do any kind of workup for those kids. However, if the kid has an atypical seizure, right, an atypical febrile seizure, so let's say instead of having a generalized seizure, they have like a focal seizure, or they have more than one seizure in a 24-hour period, or they have that seizure and they have some neurologic deficits, under those circumstances, even if it looks like a febrile seizure, you want to go ahead and do some kind of workup because those are not typical findings in a febrile seizure, okay? So atypical findings in a febrile seizure like a focal seizure or having more than one seizure in 24 hours or having a seizure with neurologic deficits, you probably want to go ahead and work that up. That's more for a third year. Now, Rice syndrome, right? Again, if you think about a child with like fever, and let's say they have like an influenza infection, and then they receive aspirin. Excuse me. And then they tell you that. Excuse me. And they tell you that the child is hypoglycemic and has a coma. Okay. Think about Rice syndrome with that. That's the classic way it presents. The associations with Rice syndrome, right, is if a child has the flu or gets like the flu vaccine or, excuse me, or has a varicella infection or gets the varicella vaccine and then they have like fever and then they give aspirin and then they get all these problems again. Think about Rice syndrome. Essentially, the only time you give aspirin to a kid is if they have Kawasaki's disease, right? I remember Kawasaki's disease classically presents with a very high fever, right? Usually it's like greater than 105 on exams. They may have like a conjunctival injection. They may have a rash on their palms and soles. Remember, Kawasaki's disease is one of the causes of a rash on the palms and soles. If you think back to your step one exam, right, you probably remember the mnemonic about a person driving Kawasaki cars with their hands and feet, right? So like Coxsackie A virus that causes hand foot mouth disease, rickettsia, rickettsii, secondary syphilis, those things can all cause a rash on the palms and soles. But Kawasaki's disease can as well, okay? So think of a high fever, conjunctival injection, rash on the palms and soles, strawberry tongue, okay? And unilateral cervical lymphadenopathy. Those things are all pretty classic for Kawasaki's disease. And under those circumstances, you generally want to give IVIG and aspirin, high dose aspirin to those kids to prevent coronary problems. Now, some other high yield seizure associations. I'm just talking about seizure associations here. If they tell you about a kid having seizures and then they say they do a lumbar puncture, and you see a lot of red cells in the CSF, right? You want to think about some kind of herpes infection, okay? Either like herpes meningitis or herpes encephalitis, which classically starts in the temporal lobes. And then don't forget your West syndrome. It's also known as infantile spasms, okay? Classic presentation is in a kid less than 2 years old, usually less than a year old on exams. And they'll tell you that the EEG shows something known as a hypsarrhythmia. And these kids tend to have intellectual disability. If you see that, think about West syndrome. It's classically associated with tuberous sclerosis. So in addition, on an exam, they may tell you that the kid has like hypopigmented macules on the skin. Those are the ash leaf spots. Or they may say, oh, they have like a cardiac tumor. Usually those are rhabdomyomas. And don't forget that it's an autosomal dominant inheritance, okay? And in addition to the cardiac rhabdomyomas, they can also have a kidney tumor known as an angiomyolipoma. So it contains blood vessels, contains muscle, and it contains fat. Now, for seizures, you can generally divide them as two types, okay? There's focal seizures and there's generalized seizures. And the thing is, focal seizures, they are seizures that are just localized to like one part of the body, okay? And the most common location of focal seizures is actually in the temporal lobe. And or at least the most common location where it like originates. But the thing is, a focal seizure can then become generalized. And then the second kind of seizure is a generalized seizure, right? And actually, an absence seizure is a kind of generalized seizure. Remember, on EEG, you classically find the three hertz as spike and slow wave activity. You don't need to be able to recognize these, but you just need to remember the buzzword. For absence seizure, 3 hertz spike and slow wave activity. For West syndrome or infantile spasms, you want to remember the classic hips arrhythmia. So now let's talk about the anti-seizure medications, right? So the first one is phenytoin, okay? It's an anti-epileptic. The way it works is that it's a sodium channel blocker, okay? So by blocking those sodium channels, you effectively keep neurons in an inactivated state, okay? So it prevents the neurons from firing. So really, if you think about it, phenytoin essentially works very similar to your class 1 antiarrhythmics, okay? And remember, those class 1 antiarrhythmics, because they work on myocardium, it should then make sense that phenytoin should potentially have cardiovascular side effects. And the thing is, phenytoin, if you remember, I've talked about this mnemonic many times. You've probably learned it as you study for step 1, that Guinness, Coronas, and PBRs induce chronic alcoholism. The P in the PBR stands for phenytoin, okay? It's a CYP450 inducer, okay? So it actually increases the metabolism of other drugs. So in general, you have to give higher doses of other drugs when a patient is on phenytoin. Classically, they describe it as a lady that has been taking OCPs and then becomes pregnant, and she's recently started a seizure medication. Think about phenytoin as the inciting med. You could also potentially think of carbamazepine. That's another CYP450 inducer, okay? Now, what do we use phenytoin for, right? So phenytoin, we classically use it to either chronically manage or acutely manage seizures, okay? And actually, let me just walk through the management pathway for seizures acutely. In general, if a patient has a seizure, you start with a short-acting benzo pretty quickly, okay? You give like diazepam or lorazepam. If that does not work, then you proceed to giving either phenytoin or fosphenytoin. Fosphenytoin is just the water-soluble form of phenytoin that can be used IV. Okay? If that doesn't work, then you proceed to a barbiturate. So again, benzo first, phenytoin or fosphenytoin second, and then a barbiturate. Now, how is a phenytoin metabolized? This is another high-yield thing to know. The thing is, I'm not going to just give you extraneous detail on these drugs. I'll just give you the high-yield ways they could potentially be tested. So the way phenytoin is metabolized is it's metabolized through a zero order elimination, okay? So basically, we've talked about this already. Remember, the rate of elimination is basically constant regardless of the dose, okay? So the plasma concentration decreases linearly with time. So you're essentially losing a fixed amount, not a fixed percent, a fixed amount of drug with time, okay? And there are other high yield drugs you want to know that are eliminated in a zero order fashion. And the mnemonic is P, like P-E-A. Remember, P is sort of shaped like a circle, which sort of looks like a zero, okay? To help you remember zero order elimination. So the drugs that are metabolized that way include phenytoin, that's the P. Ethanol, that's the E. And then aspirin, which is the A. It so happens we've talked about aspirin with Reye syndrome just earlier. And then again, constant amount of drug, zero order elimination, constant percent of drug eliminated per unit of time, that's first order elimination. Now, the thing is, phenytoin, it can actually build, because it has zero order elimination, it can build up in the bloodstream pretty quickly, and then you can get a lot of toxicity. So you generally need to watch how you give a patient phenytoin. Now, one other high yield thing you need to know about phenytoin is that it depletes folate. So the thing is, in general, if folate wants to be absorbed in the GI tract, it needs to be married, let's put it that way, it needs to be married to another amino acid to be absorbed. And the enzyme that makes that reaction happen is an enzyme known as conjugase. Okay, conjugase usually tags folate with an amino acid so that it can be absorbed in the GI tract. However, the thing is, phenytoin actually inhibits conjugase. So when you inhibit conjugase, when you inhibit conjugates with phenytoin, folate can no longer be reabsorbed, and then a megaloblastic anemia ensues. So, key thing you want to remember there, though, is if a patient has a folate deficiency, right, they'll have increased levels of homocysteine, right? I believe I've talked about that homocysteine pathway. If I've not, I'll try to talk about it in a different podcast. But basically, if a patient has a folate deficiency, don't forget that their levels of homocysteine will be high, okay? But they do not have increased levels of methylmalonic acid. Contrast that with a B12 deficiency, where the homocysteine levels are increased because B12 is a cofactor for homocysteine methyltransferase, okay, also known as methionine synthase. But in addition, you also have increased levels of methylmalonic acid because methylmalonyl CoA mutase uses vitamin B12 as a cofactor. That's the second high yield reaction that's done by vitamin B12. Now, other high yield thing of phenytoin is it can cause a gingival hyperplasia. Unfortunately, this is just a side effect you have to memorize. So this is caused by phenytoin, but it can also be caused by your calcium channel blockers and cyclosporin. And then two other things with phenytoin is it can cause fetal hydantoin syndrome. See how hydantoin rhymes with phenytoin. So fetal hydantoin syndrome classically presents as like spina bifida in a kid. Remember, if you have a folate deficiency, which is something that phenytoin can cause, you can begin to have neurotube defects like a spinal bifida, right? So spinal bifida, cleft lip, small head, right? So like microcephaly or like hypoplasia of the nails and cardiac problems. That's the cluster of findings you see with fetal hydantoin syndrome. And then phenytoin can actually also cause hirsutism. So that's just something else you want to keep in mind. Now, let's talk about carbamazepine, right? So carbamazepine is the next seizure drug I'll talk about. It also blocks sodium channels. The big thing you want to know about carbamazepine is that it's used to treat trigeminal neuralgia. Another classic name for this is tic douloureux, right? So basically, the way trigeminal neuralgia shows up on exams is when a patient has like repetitive unilateral like shooting pain in the distribution of cranial nerve 5, okay? That's why it's called a trigeminal, right? That's the fifth cranial nerve. That's why it's called a trigeminal neuralgia. The first line medication for this is carbamazepine, although you can do like some fancy kind of a neurosurgery with that. Now, what are the side effects of carbamazepine you want to know? Carbamazepine can cause agranulocytosis, just like the anti-thyroid medications, PTU and methimazole, okay? It can also cause an SIADH, right? So the syndrome of inappropriate ADH secretion, right? So if you have SIADH, you're reabsorbing more water at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct, okay, because the ADH will act on vasopressin V2 receptors so that aquaporin 2 receptors are inserted on the urine side of the principal cell and you begin to reabsorb water, right? So obviously, if you're reabsorbing a ton of water, your serum osmolality would decrease. However, your urine osmolality would increase as well. And if your urine is getting more concentrated, right, you should sort of be able to reason out that the urine specific gravity also goes up as well. Okay, they classically show like, oh, SIADH has an arrow-like question on exam. So those are something you want, things you want to keep in mind. Okay, so again, the ADH will act on the vasopressin V2 receptors on the blood side of principal cells. Remember, these V2 receptors are GS coupled. We've talked about these already. Contrast with like the vasopressin V1 receptors that are GQ coupled. Okay, and again, you cause reabsorption of water because you are inserting aquaporin channels on the urine side of the principal cells in the collecting duct. And then the last high yield thing you need to know about carbamazepine is that it actually induces cytochrome P450. Okay, so again, don't forget the mnemonic. We've talked about this already, that Guinness, Coronas, and PBRs, the S is important there, induce chronic alcoholism. Okay, so the G stands for greasyofovir. Remember, that's an antifungal that accumulates in keratin-rich tissue. Okay, the C is for carbamazepine. Okay, the P is for phenytoin. The B is for barbiturates. The R is for rifampin. Remember, that's used for TB. And then the S is for St. John's wort. Okay, that's a herbal supplement that's classically used to treat depression. Remember, it's a serotonergic agent, so it can actually trigger a serotonin syndrome. And then the chronic alcoholism, right? That's just to tell you that chronic alcoholism can actually induce cytochrome P450, but acute alcoholism does not. Acute alcoholism actually inhibits cytochrome P450, okay? So again, if a person takes a CYP450 inducer, it makes OCPs less effective, okay? Because OCPs are substrates for the cytochrome P450 enzymes. Now, the next anti-seizure med I'll talk about is valproic acid, Okay, the mechanism of action here is that it basically blocks T-type calcium channels. That's essentially the mechanism of action of ethosuximide as well. So again, don't forget, it's not L-type calcium channels, it's T-type calcium channels. They want you to know that T-type on exams. And then this drug also blocks sodium channels, so kind of like the way phenytoin works, okay? And then a final way it works is that it blocks an enzyme known as GABA transaminase. GABA transaminase is an enzyme that breaks down GABA, okay? So if you inhibit GABA transaminase, your levels of GABA increase, okay? And if those levels of GABA increase, that's good for seizures, right? Because GABA is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So it sort of calms down neurons, if you may. Okay. Now, just another high yield thing I want to mention here, though, is that if you want to make GABA, right, you make it from glutamate. And the enzyme that does that is a glutamate decarboxylase. Okay. And glutamate decarboxylase requires vitamin B6 as a cofactor. So if a patient is taking isoniazid, for example, and their vitamin B6 is depleted, okay, you have a net increase in glutamate and a net decrease in GABA because that glutamate decarboxylase doesn't work as well anymore. That's how isoniazid potentially causes seizures. Now, the next drug I'll talk about is ethosuximide, okay? The big mechanism of action you want to remember is, again, it blocks thalamic T-type calcium channels, okay? The big thing you want to know about ethosuximide is it's a relatively clean drug. It's used to treat absence seizures, okay? So again, if they give you a question about a kid less than 20 years old, they do not make this an adult question on MBMEs. They make it a pediatric question because kids usually outgrow the seizure, okay? And they tell you that you see like a 3 hertz or 3 per second spike and slow wave pattern on EEG. Again, think about absence seizures. Now, West syndrome, I've talked about this. It's basically a very severe epilepsy syndrome that's essentially composed of a triad, if you may, right? So these kids tend to have intellectual disability. They call it infantile spasms. That's the second part of the triad. And again, on an EEG, you see a very chaotic pattern. If you look this up, you see why I'm just saying it's a chaotic pattern, okay? But it's classically, the buzzword you want to remember is a hypsarrhythmia. And then vigabatrin, notice it has GABA in the name, okay? It's also an inhibitor of GABA transaminase, okay? It's an irreversible inhibitor. So the GABA builds up, okay? The reason I'm mentioning vigabatrin right after West syndrome is vigabatrin is actually one of the drugs that can be used to treat West syndrome. But here's the classic treatment for West syndrome on exams, ACTH, okay? The first line medication for the treatment of infantile spasms or West syndrome on exams is ACTH. It doesn't make any sense, but they love to test it on MBME, so you definitely want to keep that in mind, okay? You want to give ACTH. If ACTH is not an answer choice, then you can either choose steroids or vigabatrin. Now, the next seizure drug I'll talk about is lamotrigine, okay? Lamotrigine, the big thing you want to know is it increases the risk of Stevens-Johnson syndrome. I won't worry about the mechanism of action of lamotrigine, okay? Remember, Stevens-Johnson syndrome is actually a pretty classic side effect of most anti-epileptic drugs, okay? But classically, it's associated with lamotrigine or carbamazepine or phenytoin or ethosuximide. Okay, and then topiramate is the next seizure drug I'll talk about. The mechanism of action is essentially blocks AMPA receptors. Remember, AMPA is a kind of NMDA receptor, and NMDA receptors are responsive to glutamate. Okay, so if you block a glutamate sensitive receptor, right, you have a reduction in excitatory activity in neurons. Topiramate also increases GABA action. That's super low yield. It also blocks sodium channels, but again, that's also super low yield. The big thing I'll know is that it blocks AMPA receptors, okay? So it decreases a neuron's responsivity to glutamate. Now, don't forget that AMPA receptors, there are also some other receptors known as like kinase receptors, like KAI. NATE, okay, those play a role in a process known as a long-term potentiation. I'll probably describe that in a later podcast, but just remember that buzzword, long-term potentiation, okay? And don't forget, right, while we're talking about things that block receptors that are responsive to glutamate, right? Remember, NMDA receptors are one of those glutamate responsive receptors. And we already talked about a couple of drugs that can be blocked by a couple of drugs that block those NMDA receptors. We already talked about riluzole, that's used for Lou Gehrig's disease, right? So that's ALS, or memantine, okay, for Alzheimer's, right? We've also talked about dextromethorphan. I probably mentioned it in the pulmonary pharmacology podcast. And then ketamine, right? It's a dissociative anesthetic. I'll probably discuss that in the next podcast. Those all work by blocking NMDA receptors. Now, topiramate, the big things you want to know is it actually increases risk of kidney stones, okay? And it can actually cause a mental slowing. There's some actually important clinical uses of topiramate, right? So you can use it as a seizure control med, although that's rarely done. But another thing you can use It's actually done quite frequently. Sorry, I take that back. It can actually be used for weight loss, okay? So if a person has like seizures and they're obese, right? Topiramate will be a great drug for them, okay? And it can actually be used as a chronic medication for the prevention of migraines, okay? Now, the last few drugs I'll probably talk about here before I quickly talk about the insomnia drugs are the benzos, okay, and barbiturates, okay? And I guess I can just throw in baclofen here for good measure. So these drugs essentially all work on GABA receptors, okay? Remember, the GABA receptor is a chloride channel, okay? And chloride, it's primarily an extracellular ion. So when it flows into the cells down a chloride channel, it hyperpolarizes the cell and the cell does not fire. So barbiturates and benzos, they work on GABA A receptors, okay? And the big mnemonic you want to remember here, you've probably seen it in some step one study resource, that Ben likes to have it more frequently, but Barb likes it to last longer, okay? So benzos, they increase the frequency of opening of chloride channels, but barbiturates increase the duration. Or you can, instead of saying barbiturates, you can say barbiturates, okay? Barbiturates increase the duration of chloride channel opening, okay? Contrast that with baclofen, that actually works on GABA B receptors, okay? So remember the B in baclofen for the B in GABA B, okay? But your benzos and barbiturates both work on GABA A receptors. So benzos and barbiturates, remember, they can cause a severe respiratory depression, okay, and they actually have a pretty increased risk of dependence or addiction. That's why these drugs are not prescribed like willy-nilly for like chronic management of stuff, okay? And actually, I want to compare and contrast something here, right? So remember, opioids are addictive and they can also cause a respiratory depression, but on an exam question, they will give you that the person has pinpoint pupils, okay? So they have pupillary meiosis if a patient has like opioid intoxication. Contrast that with benzos and barbiturates. They can cause respiratory depression, but the pupillary findings will be normal, okay? That's a classic way to differentiate those on exams. And the thing is, if a patient has like respiratory depression from a barbiturate, is there anything you can do? Well, you can intubate them and call your friendly anesthesiologist, but really there's no reversal agent for a barbiturate overdose. However, for a benzo, you can actually reverse that with flomazenil. Okay, flomazenil is a competitive inhibitor that can displace benzos from the GABA, from the surface of the GABA receptor, the GABA A receptor. Okay, now let me end this by talking about some high yield integrations. I also talk about baclofen for a short while, but let me talk about the insomnia drugs. Okay, they're essentially all GABA receptor agonists. Okay. You use them to treat insomnia, okay, and they're the Z drugs, okay, like Zolpidem, Zaleplon, and Zobiclone, okay. You can actually reverse these drugs with flomazenil. That's another pretty classic but unusual exam question. Now, one other drug that can be used for insomnia, right? So let's think about this disorder, narcolepsy, right? So narcolepsy is a classic condition where a person feels sleepy during the day. So think of narcolepsy as an excessive sleep disorder, right? If you think back to this, in narcolepsy, patients tend to have a deficiency of something known as hypocretin, or also known as orexin in their CSF, okay? So they have low levels of orexin, also called hypocretin, in the CSF. So just put this chemical equation in your mind, that low levels of hypocretin or low levels of orexin can... So put this equation in your mind that low levels of orexin, also called hypocretin, are associated with excessive sleep, okay? So what would you potentially want to do to orexin receptors if you were trying to treat insomnia? Well, hopefully you're thinking that you want to block those things, because by blocking those things, you essentially You essentially induce like a narcoleptic state, if you may, and you can cause the person to sleep really well, okay? So that's how a drug known as suvorexant works. Suvorexant is an orexin receptor antagonist that's used for the treatment of insomnia. It's a relatively new drug, but it could show up on step one. Now, some other high yield integrations here, right? So let's assume you get an exam question about a patient that takes like a barbiturate, and then they begin to have like skin problems and neurologic deficits, and they have like abdominal pain, and they have like vision problems, right? So what are you thinking about here? I'll give you some time to think. Okay, well, I hope you're thinking about AIP, acute intermittent porphyria, okay? The thing is, barbiturates can trigger this, right? So those heme synthesis pathway problems are very high for step one and for step two, and I'll imagine also for step three, okay? So remember, in AIP, right, there is a deficiency of porphobilinogen deaminase. I think about it as a peanut butter and jelly deaminase, like PBG deaminase. But basically, right, so porphobilinogen deaminase deficiency, basically you have a buildup of heme synthesis pathway intermediates, and those are bad for the skin, and in addition they can cause neurodeficits because those intermediates can deposit in the brain, although those neurodeficits are generally reversible. Barbiturates, again, are generally contraindicated in a patient that has any heme synthesis pathway defect, all right, like AIP with PBG deaminase, or if a patient has like a porphyria cutanea tarda, which I believe is a uroporphyrinogen decarboxylase or UROD deficiency. Okay, so again, if you give a barbiturate, barbiturates induce the enzymes in the heme synthesis pathway. So you have increased flux through the pathway. But remember, you have like this buildup, right? So it's just like saying that, oh, there is a road blockade. You're supposed to be removing cars from that road so that you don't have like really bad traffic. But when you give a barbiturate, you are like sending more cars down that pathway, okay? So you have like a very, very bad traffic, and cars will begin to build up behind that road blockade, and the roadblock, I guess in this case, is the UROD or the PBG deaminase deficiency, okay? So barbiturates increase flux through this pathway, so you have an increase in those bad substrates that can then cause the skin and neuro problems and all the issues you get with heme synthesis pathway defects, okay? And in general, for these diseases, right, like AIP or porphyria cutanea tarda, you want to give heme and glucose, okay, because remember, those can inhibit the rate-limiting enzyme of heme synthesis, ALA synthase, okay? Remember, ALA synthase uses vitamin B6 as a cofactor. That's one way that isoniazid can cause a sideroblastic anemia, right? Because by depleting B6, ALA synthesis doesn't work, okay? So you have no ability to synthesize protoporphyrin. Okay, now, another high yield thing I want to talk about here is Crigler-Najjar syndrome, okay? Basically, this is a deficiency of UDP-GT, okay? UDP glucuronosyl transferase. It's the enzyme that converts indirect to direct bilirubin. Okay, so if a patient has Crigler-Najjar syndrome, they have an indirect hyperbilirubinemia. Okay, so the thing is, there are two types of Crigler-Najjar syndrome. There's a type one where you have like absolutely no UDP-GT activity. That's fatal. Kids are usually not born with that. And then there's a type two where they have like less than, let's say, like 10% activity. Okay, and basically the way you treat that or even confirm that diagnosis is to give barbiturates. Okay, barbiturates, again, they induce cytochrome P450 enzymes. Remember, the B in that Guinness Coronas and PBRs mnemonic stands for barbiturates. Okay, so you give barbiturates, they increase the endogenous activity of those UDP GT enzymes. Okay, and that can be used as a diagnostic test and as a treatment for Crigler-Najjar type 2, because by giving barbiturates, you induce cytochrome P450 and enzymes, of which UDP-GT is one of them, okay, and that basically like increases the amount of those enzymes or increases the activity, okay, and that can lower the indirect bilirubin levels in Crigler-Najjar syndrome type 2, okay. So because I've talked about barbiturates, I just decided to introduce this here, okay. And another quick thing here is, if a patient has liver disease, okay, the only benzos you can give them, benzos you can remember with the mnemonic LOT, okay, so like lorazepam, oxazepam, and temazepam. The reasoning here is that these benzos, it's not that they are not metabolized by the liver, they are metabolized by the liver, okay, but they are metabolized by glucuronidation, which is a relatively minor pathway in the liver, if you may, or let's think of it this way, it's a pathway that still exists when the liver is on its last legs. And then don't forget chlordiazepoxide, that's another benzo. If you've worked in the hospital for any period of time, you've probably heard of Librium. Librium is chlordiazepoxide epoxide. It's a long-acting benzo. It's classically used for alcohol withdrawal. Okay, remember that if a patient withdraws from alcohol or benzos or barbs, that withdrawal is actually fatal. Most other withdrawal syndromes, they suck, but they are not fatal. But these three, benzos, barbs, and alcohol, the withdrawal can be fatal. Okay, and then baclofen, I already mentioned this already. It's a GABA B receptor agonist. It's used in like cerebral palsy, okay, because it can relieve increased muscle tone. And again, don't forget that it's a GABA B receptor agonist versus your benzos and your barbs that are GABA A receptor agonists. So hopefully you've taken a lot from this seizure podcast. I will continue with neuropharmacology in our next podcast. I wish you a wonderful day ahead, and I guess it's time for me to be on service. Have a wonderful day, and God bless. Thank you.